This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at REACH 2015, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 19 and 20, 2015.
Although the duties that the Lord has given me in life have involved a fair amount of church or of leadership and ministry, it's really never involved something that has really been highly structured or deep-pocketed or has extensive staff and so forth. But I think that nevertheless, whether the ministries that we're involved in is school or church or church planting or relief or various different ministries, when we work together, there are various different issues that have a bearing on how well we work together and how well we're able to accomplish the purpose for which we are working together. It's not my goal today to give specific details on exactly how a particular mission or ministry ought to be structured, rather to focus on some structural issues that I think that whatever the ministry ought to look at and why these things matter. Now, since a big portion of my ministry and my life as ministry and in leadership has involved my call to be a preacher, I hope you'll indulge the fact that I'm using a biblical basis for my remarks today rather than a business basis. One of the ministries that I think that is the most effective ministries that I know of is the ministry that the Apostle Paul was involved in his ministry in which was a church planting ministry. And his context and his circumstances had less structure than probably what we ought to have today, and was a freer structure than probably what we ought to have today. But yet, I think as we look into the Scripture, there are relationships and things that we can see from his ministry that merit our attention and our application in structuring our own ministries for effectiveness. So you have a hand out there that have the different issues that I think we ought to look at today. The first one is that as we structure our ministries, they ought to be structured to be God-centered. Now, in Thessalonians, in the first book, to the letter to the Thessalonians, in chapter 2, Paul says this, and I'd like to read 6 verses there. "For you yourselves know, brethren, that our coming to you was not in vain, but even after we had suffered before and were spitefully treated at Philippi, as you know, we were bold in our God to speak to you the gospel of God in much conflict. For our exhortation did not come from error or uncleanness, nor was it in deceit, but as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, even so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God who tests our hearts. For neither at any time did we use flattering words, as you know, nor a cloak of covetousness, God is witness. Nor did we seek glory from men, either from you or from others, when we might have made our demands as the apostles of Christ." The Apostle Paul was very concerned that his ministry be God-centered. He didn't want the attention to be on himself. And so he says, neither did we seek glory from men. And he was very careful how he related as a leader in the ministry that he was involved in. Now, there's much to appreciate about Billy Graham, and I think one of the things about Billy Graham's ministry that is worthy of our emulation is the integrity that he showed, and even in secular circles or in liberal circles, the integrity that he showed in terms of his own personal conduct and relationship was outstanding. There is no scandal with Billy Graham in terms of money or in terms of morality relating to the opposite sex. Another thing that I've been challenged by Billy Graham was that he is unashamed of the gospel. And if he met with Prime Minister Churchill or whoever, he spoke about the Lord. There was a lot to appreciate and some things not to appreciate about Billy Graham ministry. But we don't read in Scripture about an Apostle Paul Evangelistic Association. You won't find that there. Behind many ministries You often find an individual of exceptional vision, of a lot of commitment, of holy ambition, perhaps even leadership, perhaps not, of leadership qualities. But Paul seems to be one of those people who had a lot of vision. He had holy ambition. He had commitment. He had leadership ability. But from the human perspective, he seems to have been very dominant in the ministry that he was involved in. But even so, even though on occasion he did assert his authority was generally asserted in the context of church administration in terms of right or wrong, something that needed to be dealt with in the church. But you don't see the Apostle Paul, I don't believe he was a person who was just around throwing his weight around and trying to make a name for himself. If you go to Philippians chapter 1, I think it is, where Paul is talking about while he was in prison, there was someone or some people who was apparently trying to use that opportunity to advance themselves and to become more prominent than he was. And he says he wasn't really putting his blessing on the way these people were acting, but he was thankful that the gospel was being preached, even though it was with less than noble motives. I think that effective ministries don't need someone to always be highlighting that they founded this ministry or that they are the chief administrator or they're chairman of the board and so forth. The tendency to pride, to preeminence, to jealousy, those things need to be dealt with both personally and organizationally. If you are involved in ministry, you need to deal with those issues yourself, with your own being. Before God to deal with those things. But organizationally, the ministry needs to be dealing with those things as well so that the ministry is structured to be God-centered and it's not structured to be centered on the founder or the chairman or the lead missionary or the lead aid worker or whoever it is. The focus rather should be on God and his work. So structure your ministry to be God-focused. The second thing that we need to look at in structuring our ministries has to do with structuring for legitimacy and accountability. And I'd like to read for this and for the next point from Acts chapter 13. And it's the part there where the Holy Spirit instructed the church at Antioch to separate certain people for a particular ministry. It says this in Acts 13, verses 1 to 3. Now, in the church that was in Antioch, there were certain prophets and teachers, and it names who they were. As they ministered to the Lord and fasted, the Holy Spirit said, "Now separate to me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I have called them." Then having fasted and prayed and laid hands on them, they sent them away. Then what follows is, a record of the time of their journey, that particular what we refer to as the first missionary journey. Then in chapter 14, verse 25, it says this, "Now when they had preached the word in Perga, they went down to Antilia. From there they sailed to Antioch, where they had been commended to the grace of God for the work which they had completed. Now when they had come and gathered the church together, they reported all that God had done with them and that he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles, so they stayed there for a long time with the disciples." The question before us is this: how may a ministry's constituency or potential constituency have reasonable confidence that this particular ministry is legitimate or that those who are involved in the ministry are people of integrity or that the ministry is doing the task, is actually doing the task that it's purporting to do, or that it is worthy of financial support, or that funds are being spent and used responsibly, or that there's broad knowledge and a pool of wisdom to draw on in that ministry? How may the constituents or the potential constituency have confidence that there is legitimacy and there is accountability? And so your ministry needs to be structured. Our ministries need to be structured with that in mind to address those questions. How was Paul's missionary ministry His was a church planting ministry. But how was it legitimized? It was legitimized by the church. The church selected, responded to the Spirit, and set apart Paul, Saul, and Barnabas for this particular task. And sometimes that's the way Christian ministries are legitimized. They're legitimized by the church. Some Christian ministries transcend a local church. They draw from a larger span. They minister alongside the church, and we call those parachurch organizations. But whether the ministry is directly from a church or whether it is a parachurch ministry, legitimacy is generally mediated through a board of directors. In other words, the board represents and itself should be accountable to the body that it is purporting to represent, to be answerable to the whole. Now, some boards are elected directly by the supporting body. Some are somewhat representative of the supporting body, but are basically self-perpetuating, and others are wholly autonomous. It seems to me that, generally speaking, the more closely the directors themselves are subjected to the supporting constituency, the greater the legitimacy and accountability of the ministry itself. If this board is wholly autonomous, they do what they want to. They themselves choose their own successors. They're on the board for as long as they want to be. Then that board has a decreasing level of accountability and legitimacy to a board who is directly chosen from the constituency body. And the constituency body has input in choosing those directors. That is how legitimacy is mediated. It's not that there's only one way to do it, but I would just suggest that as a general rule, the closer the board is accountable to the constituency, the selection of that board, the more legitimacy and accountability the ministry itself has. Now, organizations are like many other things in life. The natural tendency over time is to lose vigor, is to wind down. Leaders exhaust their range of ideas. They kind of get in a rut. Programs can get tired and can get outdated. That is a natural tendency of organizations, of ministries. And ministries profit from renewal that comes from timely rotation of the board of directors. I'd like to make a couple quotes from Edgar Stoes. Edgar Stoes was a person who has served on various boards and a variety of nonprofit organizations. He was at one time chairman of the board, I believe, of Habitat for Humanity. And I've drawn some things from my remarks from him, but he says this, two things. Systems that operate as mutual admiration society do not renew themselves. A system that operates as a mutual admiration society do not renew themselves. Secondly, healthy, renewing systems have a steady rotation of people coming and going. I think that a key word here is timely. There's a balance to be struck between knowledge and wisdom that come from experience and the infusion of new blood, new ideas, fresh vitality that comes with new people. And the complexity of the ministry, the size of the board may have some bearing on what is timely. There is not just a one-time fits all. And I would say, too, that everyone on the board should be subjected to the same shelf life. You shouldn't carve out that certain people are privileged, they get certain tenure, and other people are just peons, and they can only get so much privilege. Whatever happens, it should happen across the board. If people want to hang on, board of directors want to hang on because they see themselves as being indispensable, or because they feel ownership or possessiveness, or because their fulfillment and meaning in life is tied up in being on directors on that board, then it's probably past time for change. It's time for renewal. The third thing, then, in terms of structuring ministries that we need to look at, and that is structure to clarify roles. Structure to clarify proper roles. Again, quoting or referring to something that Edgar Stoes says, he said this, that nonprofit and church boards spend more time in meetings than boards of large corporations, such as General Motors. Now, maybe not in the last year with all the problems that General Motors had, but as a rule of thumb, that boards of nonprofits and church boards spend more time in meetings than boards of large corporations. And why is that? It's in part because of a lack of clarity about roles. Either conceptually, there's a conceptual lack of clarity about what the role is, or in a practical way, that the roles are confused or overlap. There's a lot of inefficiency. There's a lot of bad relationships. There's a lot of bad attitudes, a lot of frustration, a lot of just general relationship issues that can be circumvented if there is a clear understanding about the proper roles. Sometimes, for various reasons, the board can so micromanage the ministry that those who actually have the most skin in the game, those who are actually dedicating their lives to fulfilling the mission of the ministry, feel marginalized. Conversely, the board sometimes can feel threatened or even be disrespected by visionary and ambitious people who are on the ground fulfilling the ministry of the board, of the mission. At the other end of the spectrum, a board can just become a group of yes people who just rubber stamp what some strong administrator or something wants to do. And the board then, in that time, has abdicated their responsibility as well. And so each entity has got their role. That role needs to be clarified. There needs to be clear understanding of what the role is. There's a lot that we don't know about the structure of the missionary enterprise, that the ministry that Paul and Barnabas and later on developed around Paul. But on the particular one that we're looking at here in the first missionary journey, there's a lot that we don't know. For instance, was Paul and Barnabas released? Were they released from their responsibilities in Antioch and told, you go find your own way? Or were they sent by the church with a specific task? How much direction did the church actually give, the constituency actually give, or the board of directors, however you want to look? Or was there some blending of the two, of how much they were to find their own way and how much there was some actual direction given? Of course, we realize that at that time, there was not the communication there is now, and of course, this was the new thing to a certain degree of the particular nature of their own ministry, and so they were going to have to follow the Spirit and find their own way. It is interesting that in speaking of their return to Antioch, where they had been commended by the grace of God for the work, the Scripture talks about their work having been completed. Now, what does that mean, that their work was completed? Did they complete the task that they had been sent to do by the church? Or were they just another way of saying, well, they had made the circle, they were done? Well, I don't know. There's a lot here that we don't know, and I don't want to make too much of the relationship between the Antioch church and those who were sent out in this ministry. But there apparently was some understanding between the church and between Saul, Paul, and Barnabas as to really what the roles were and how they were to function. Structuring ministries for effectiveness requires distinguishing between the roles of governance and of operation. Okay, who is going to govern this organization, this ministry, and who are the ones who are actually carrying it out? The ones who are actually carrying it out, we'll call the operations. Those who are in control and who are setting the direction is the governance. In general, the role of the board of directors is that of governance. That is the role of the board under the constituency. If it hasn't already been determined by the constituency, constituent body, the role of the board of governance is to determine what the purpose of this ministry is. Now, in the general session, Brother Mullet was talking about some things that I'm about to talk about right here. And he might have used slightly different terminology, different words, but there'll be an overlap of some of the issues that he addressed and what I'm talking about in a general way. But the role of governance is to decide what really is the purpose, what is to be accomplished by this ministry, the ends for which the ministry exists. Now, within that framework of the purpose, the board needs to address two things. One thing is vision, which has to do with the future, and one has to do with mission, and that is what is present. You know, what is actually to be done right now in order to accomplish the purpose for which this ministry exists, and what is to be in the future? What is the planning for in the future? Governance also involves making definite plans by which to accomplish the ministry that the mission is committed to. And in deciding about those plans, then they need to form certain policies, which are the instructions that are given for those who carry it out. And so if you're the board and you are planning, what is the purpose of this? What is this? Why do we exist? And what then are our plans for carrying this out immediately? And what might be our plans in the future for carrying this out? And how are those who are actually supposed to carry this out to function? Those are the policies that are set into place and to deal with the different issues. So governance involves making definite plans by which to accomplish the mission the ministry is committed to, forming policies which are instructions by which the plans are to be carried out. Now, part of governance then is also securing the administrative personnel who are actually going to carry this mission out. And then the board needs to get out of the way. The next step then is the operatives. The operations are to the domain of those that have been secured by the board to carry out the ministry's mission. It involves administrators who are in charge, and it involves the rest of the people on the ground, other personnel who are implementing the ministry, the mission of the ministry. Why is it so important to clarify this division of roles? Well, between the board and between the administration, between the governing and between the operation. Why is it so important? One is to reduce misunderstandings and promote good relationships. And I've mentioned that already. But without this clarity and without this respect, it's easy for people to think that someone else is treading on ground that is theirs. And so there's this feeling that you are treading in my turf. But we need to clarify that. One of the great ways to destroy morale of a ministry is for those charged with governance and overall policymaking to so micromanage the administration of that ministry that the administrators just feel like it kills their initiative. It kills their morale. Or let's look at it this way. Let's look at it in terms of a school. You have a school board, and then you have the administration, the principal, and you have the teachers. And the school board can be so detached that it really is not given direction that they ought to on the governance thing. And so when the problems come up in the school, the administration can't go back and say, well, the board has set this policy. When the administration can say the board has set this policy, it gives them authority as administrators because they are carrying out the policies of the directors. On the other hand, the board can be so involved that the principal, who really knows a lot about school, And maybe he is putting his life into that, and that is his career, and he feels like he's just pushing paper. One of the banks in our area was taken over by Wells Fargo, a much larger bank, and I was dealing with a person in that bank, sitting in a big office. I don't know whether he was the branch manager or what, but since they had been taken over by Wells Fargo, he says, I don't do anything that a monkey can't be trained to do. And so administrators generally like to have more initiative than that. You ought to have an administrator that desires to have more initiative than that. And if the board is so micromanaging the administration that he feels like that he's doing nothing that a monkey can't be trained to do, well, he may go find someplace where it's more challenging to work. So it's important to have this distinction. Also, it's important to clarify roles to encourage efficiency. There's no reason why boards need to spend so much time trying to administer that from which they are distant both geographically and operationally. If the administrators by necessity are young or inexperienced, well, then provide training for them to do the job, for them to do their jobs. Don't just do their jobs for them. Another reason to clarify roles is to unleash operations to function. Administrators and staff are the people who are, in a sense, putting the most into the ministry. They're the ones who are dedicating their lives. That is their life. That is their job. The directors, they meet every once in a while, and they go back home to their own jobs. And so they need to be unleashed so that they can really perform and bring some initiative and all into their own, into the ministry. Operatives, the administrators, the personnel, they are a tremendous resource to the board. They're positioned to generate the most ideas, to understand the rising problems, to detect the faulty solutions. They need to be included properly. At the same time, when boards are properly detached from operations, from the nitty-gritty of what's going on, then they're able to see the proverbial forest instead of the trees. If boards are so tightly involved in administration and the operation of the ministry, then you lose that distance perspective that a board can bring to it. Now, this matter of clarity of roles is so important or so heartfelt that I'd like to make just a few more comments about it. Administrators need access to the board. I was in a situation of administration and over a period of years, and depending on my relationship to the board changed over time. It was a learning curve for both of us. But the administration needs to have access to the board to where the administrator doesn't just come in and present something, then he's dismissed, while the board then can discuss it. And the administrator is not there to say, no, you're misunderstanding what I'm trying to say, or you're going off on a rabbit trail, or this is not doesn't seem workable. The administration needs to be there. The governance needs to be there to where they can ask the hard questions, not to where they can bully the board. The board needs to be in charge. They're where the governance is, but there needs to be that communication to where they know the real problems and have the hard questions and help generate the reasonable and workable plans. Care also needs to be taken to avoid an adversarial relationship between the board and the administration. Those who are operatives, the administration, the personnel, do need to know that the board is the governance. They need to respect the role and the authority of the board. At the same time, the board needs to be empathetic to the plight of those under their governance, particularly the administrators. Would you like to run a construction business or a retail business or a farm under the control of a board? Perhaps the board you serve under. How many of you would like to run your personal business under a board? it's necessary in ministry to have that board to mediate and to bring to mediate between what they feel an important role. But we do need to be empathetic to that fact that we generally, as people, don't like to work our own personal businesses under those types of relationships. It's something that can build empathy if you have been asked to serve on a board. One other thing, why do boards tend to stray from governance to operations? Why is it that boards tend to get to micromanage what's going on? One of the reasons might be just lack of understanding. Another reason might be that the organization is so small or so young that it's easy to just step in and do those things. And it might be over time that needs more care needs to be to separate that out. Another reason might be that oftentimes people who serve as directors are people who themselves are somewhat self-starters or who run their own businesses. And so they're used to running their own businesses. They're used to running the ministry on which they are a board. They just carry over their own entrepreneurship and bring that to bear in an unhealthy way in terms of governance and operation structure. Well, let's move on. Structure number four. Structure for meaningful involvement and development. Because of the way the book of Acts is written, it's easy for us to speak of Paul's ministry, to use that kind of terminology, and Paul's missionary journey. And there's no getting around the fact that he was a dominant and a prominent figure in terms of what was going on. But a careful tabulation would indicate that really Paul was involved in an extensive networking of people that were in his orbit. And I just want to read one of those passages, and that would be in 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 9 to 12. And to Tychius I have sent to Ephesus, bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas when you come, and the books, especially the parchments. Alexander the coppersmith did me much harm. May the Lord repay him according to his works. Paul says, here's this person, here's that person, and I won't go to other passages in scriptures. You can go to Romans 16, where he's giving specific greetings to different people, and a number of times where he talks about my fellow laborer or my co-worker, that thing. And so Paul really was involved with a lot of people. Apparently he understood that outside of distinctly spiritual resources, in terms of the Holy Spirit and such things, that the greatest, the most viable resource in accomplishing the mission of his ministry, so to speak, was people. And he involved himself with people. He involved people in his ministry, not primarily to serve as his valets, so that he would have somebody to wash his car and to cut his grass, so that he could be freed then for the really important things of ministry. But that's not why I don't believe Paul had people involved in his ministry. He had people involved as apprentices. He was developing those people, and then he in turn sent those people on their own tasks. For instance, Timothy, he said, what was it, the reason I left you in Ephesus was to do so-and-so, and he sent Titus to Corinth, to Crete. Another time, Paul was in Athens, was it? And he says, he wrote back to one of the churches, and says, when I could stand it no longer, I sent Timothy back to you. And so Paul had this whole network of people who, in effect, he was actually apprenticing and developing. And those are the people then who can be used further on in developing the task that the ministry has. People should be valued not just for what they do, but for who they are as God's servants. One of the things that impressed me as a student was a teacher I had when he prayed before class, before the students, and he would say, Lord, bless these, your servants, or whatever. And he didn't just consider us as students. He considered us God's servants. He imparted dignity just in the way he prayed for those that he prayed for. People who are involved in ministry on the grunt level are people who generally are not just looking for a job because the economy is poor. That I do think has an effect. And it does have an effect if there's a draft for people who go into VS. How many people come? I understand that. But generally people who go to the bother to volunteer or to respond to serve in ministry are people who are genuinely interested and that need to be developed and need to be appreciated, encouraged. People are valued when the ministry is structured in a way that affirms everyone's significance, that gives them a sense of vital participation, that they're not just, you're stuck back in the kitchen, but that person doesn't really feel that they have input, that they are in vital participation, and that also gives opportunities for appropriate input. I think I want to move on. Let me say this, that potential resource of the human resource of people in ministry of being a future contribution for developing that ministry is lost when the ministry is structured in such a way as to when they are not valued and when there is conflict because proper roles are not being determined. And so it's important to keep these things in balance so that the individuals who are involved in the ministry are valued, feel appreciation, feel that they are meaningfully contributing to the purpose for which the ministry exists. Lastly, structure to focus on outcome, not on activities. The particular ministry that Paul was involved in was a church planting ministry, what we would call a church planting ministry, to evangelize unreached people. That seems to be his focus. And so just simple activity was not sufficient for Paul. He had a particular focus. He had a certain outcome in a way that he wanted to see happen. He wrote to the Corinthian church. He said he hoped that as their faith increased, he would be able to extend his ministry to regions beyond. And so, see, his focus was on regions beyond. People who did not know. He had a strategic activity in mind. The Roman believers, he wrote that he had never come to visit them because his main aim was to preach the gospel where Christ was not named. But now he was going to Spain, and so he would plan to stop by on his way to Spain. Well, whether he ever made it to Spain or not, I don't know. But the point is, just activity in itself was not enough for Paul. He had strategic activity. It wasn't just do something. He was looking for outcome, not just activity. And so ministries should be structured to focus on outcome. It seems like the longest that Paul was at any one place was 3 years when he was at Ephesus. Now, my point is not to say that all missionary ministries must be modeled on his. Rather, it's the point of that our activity should be outcome-oriented rather than just doing something. Outcome for him was evangelizing the unreached, or at least preaching the gospel to the unevangelized. Effective ministries are structured to know their purpose and to focus on the outcome. Not just to be busy so they can send reports back to Antioch and say, look, we've done this, and we've done this, and we've done this, and keep the constituency happy and keep the money going. Rather, are we really accomplishing the purpose for which we exist? Now, I want to quickly say that focusing on outcome rather than activities doesn't mean that a given ministry isn't effective or worthy or functioning under the blessing of God if its outcome seems to be lesser than another. That's not how God measures things. If you don't grow corn, maybe some of you are from the Midwest, but if you can't grow corn like they grow corn in the Midwest, does that mean that the rest of us shouldn't grow corn? No, it doesn't mean that. But it does mean that if our task is to grow corn, we shouldn't spend most of our time tinkering in the shop. We need to be busy about what it takes to grow corn in our particular context. So effective ministries are structured to where the purpose is clear. And that then serves as a guidepost by which to evaluate our activities. Is this just something to keep the people busy, to keep the constituency happy, or do we need to change our activity to accomplish our purpose? Or do we need to change our purpose? And sometimes that can happen. That it can happen that as we become involved, we see that, well, perhaps we had the wrong purpose. Our purpose needs to be tweaked because right here is where the need is. And so we can tweak our purpose, but keep your ministry structured so that the purpose is clear, your plan is clear, and then you can have something by which to evaluate. Is this activity contributing to the purpose? And what difference will it make if I involve myself in this activity? Abraham Lincoln is supposed to have said that he never thought a man lost time by stopping to sharpen his axe. And effective ministries like sharp axes come in different shapes. But effective ones are shaped to be God-centered, shaped to provide legitimacy and accountability, shaped to clarify proper roles, shaped for meaningful involvement and development of human resources, and they're shaped to function, focus on outcome, not just on activities. We've got a few minutes here yet. If you have some input, areas that perhaps you're involved in that you feel that I have grossly overlooked or that I have grossly mishandled. Okay. Yeah, okay. His question was that in those in operations, meeting with the board, should that be represented by one individual, or should it be represented by itself, by a team? And I don't know that I have a pat answer for that. I mean, there is the possibility that as the chain of command, so to speak, goes up to the one individual, that he can go to the board and misrepresent the organization, can misrepresent what is really happening. And so that is a danger. And so I would think it would have something to do with, you know, how large the organization is, whether you have multiple administrators, but that is a legitimate concern of to whether the concerns of operations are adequately and with being represented with integrity.
What's your opinion? Which is better, or is there any better?
I'm afraid that if I say something, I'll be saying the wrong thing. Okay.
One thing I think
there needs to be trust and integrity. We need to be careful not to make people feel they are being undercut, or that they are. I don't quite trust your answer, so I have to go somewhere else. But if you structure to go ahead and have some broad input, but yet, if someone is given a responsibility, then that person needs to have the authority to carry their responsibility out and not to be undermined. Someone else has something?
Okay.
So I don't know whether your churches are involved in Vacation Bible School or not. Do you do any strategic planning for Vacation Bible School? Where shall we go to invite children, or how shall we do this? Or Is this an evangelistic Bible school, or is this just for our own children? How do we maintain control? Some of that is strategic planning, right? So I think it's in order. Of course, you know, this should not just be a human activity that we as a bunch of men and women sit down and plan this thing, and God is over here, and after a while we ask him to bless our thing. You know, God needs to be in on the strategic planning. Okay.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.